slides as well.
Okay, so welcome to From Connection to Cooperation, Creating Effective Classroom Management Strategies Using Attachment Theory and Social Emotional Learning. I'm Savannah Couch. I'm a registered drama therapist and licensed professional counselor. Some of you may know me. I work at Midwest Rapua Health Center as a part of the behavioral health team. And I'm also a trained facilitator in Circle of Security Parenting, which is an early intervention attachment program. So a lot of my work is really focused on the relationships between children, typically caregivers, but really all the adults around them, because that is the setting for all of their social development, emotion regulation skill development, and also, in this case, academic development. And so this presentation is going to go through some of the ways that we can use the basics of attachment theory, so that understanding of how you as the adult are supporting their development and creating that sense of safety, and social emotional development and learning, so how children are learning and acquiring those social skills and emotion regulation skills in the context of that relationship to build classroom management strategies that feel a little bit more smooth and are also facilitating your students' development. So regardless of what age you teach, these principles are going to apply, but obviously the developmental needs of a first grader are probably going to look different, or hopefully look different, from that of a 12th grader. So there's definitely a lot of nuance within this conversation, and I hope you can think of some examples in your own classroom to think about the needs of your students specifically. Okay. So by the end of this presentation today, hopefully you will have a basic understanding of attachment theory and why that's relevant to the teacher-student relationship. You'll be able to define and understand the basic principles of social-emotional development and social-emotional learning. You'll understand the connections between your relationship with your students, their social-emotional learning and development, and classroom management. And we'll spend some time towards the end discussing and exploring ways to actually apply this in your own teaching practice. Okay. So just to start us off, if you feel more comfortable writing, there is a space on the handout to do this, but I'd like you all to take a moment just to reflect on your experiences as a student. So thinking back to who a favorite teacher might have been and why, and what you remember about that teacher or their class. So if you want to take a moment to write it down, or if anyone feels ready to share, just raise your hand. Yes, in the back in the gray shirt. Of course. There's no test. It's really whatever is going to help your learning the best. Okay.
I'm not sure.
Yeah.
So I have been so sure she was my fourth grade teacher. It was just projects. I just wrote the projects.
It sounds like it was really engaging and just sparked your interest.
Yeah.
Okay. No way. So remember the fun projects. Anything else people remember? Yes.
One great teacher, but I had a few teachers when I was in 12th grade. They shared some more thing. I had three GA teachers who I really liked them, and when I first became a teacher, I would like more than that. So I had to think about those three teachers. Basically, they didn't do anything spectacular other than they just really loved when they taught. Like, they didn't have to, like, show it off. And I felt like they didn't need to demand our compliance to say who they were being. We just respect them because they respect themselves and they respect the others. They're very loving, caring, and nurturing them, which is why I really like them so much.
Yeah, it sounds like there was a lot of warmth in the relationships you saw between them and also with them and you, and that led to really positive memories of the classes. Anybody else want to share? If you have right there.
So my absolute favorite teacher, his name is Gary Chapman, and when computers were first coming out, and he got us all involved in computers in some way. Like, he met us all at our level.
Yeah.
None of us, like, knew who we were, right? But it was, like, super interactive and engaging. He wouldn't let anybody, like, stand on the side next to him. He made sure that everybody was involved.
So I heard a lot of just like pulling everyone in the class and making everyone feel a part of the group and encouraging that connection with other classmates and with him and with what you were learning. Okay. I'm going to stop it there for time. We will have more time to share other things later. But generally, it seems like there is a theme of teachers recognizing what students enjoy, having the warmth in the relationship that leaves that positive memory of this was a really positive class, regardless of what you learned. Which sets the stage for us to talk about attachment theory. So attachment theory is the psychological theory that caregiver-child relationships are significant for social and emotional development. So the way I like to think of it is that attachment relationship is the setting where all skills are developing. Now, I know this is focused on the caregiver-child relationship because that is the main focus of if we're getting really deep into like attachment theory and research. But the components of the attachment relationship are mirrored in teacher-student relationships, and that's something that's also been shown in research. So the initial explanation of attachment theory will be focused on the caregiver relationship, but I promise we're going to talk about how it applies to your classrooms as well. Okay. So within attachment, there are two main roles that the attachment figure or that adult or primary caregiver is taking. The first role is that of the secure base, and the second is that of the safe haven. So if we think about, really basically, a child's two main needs in development, there is the need to go out and explore the world, to try and understand and contextualize everything around them. If you think of like an infant or a toddler, just how curious they are about everything, because that's informing both their understanding of others, but also their understanding of themselves. And there's a need to come in for comfort, for that protection, connection, helping a child understand their internal experiences. Think of that same toddler, they go 1 minute from being so enamored with everything around them to then having a full-on meltdown for seemingly no reason. So what that might look like in terms of what the attachment figure, the adult, is doing, we want to think of the example of a child on a playground. You see that child running off with their friends, climbing on the equipment, but you notice those moments where they turn back to see if their parent is watching, and that gleam in their eye when they make eye contact with their parents and there's that smile, right? It's facilitating and supporting that exploration. It's saying, yes, go do that. And then if that child falls off the equipment, scrapes their knee, the parent going in or the child going to the parent for that comforting, the soothing, that's the role of the safe haven. And I really didn't clarify the going out part and the look would be the role of the secure base. And then generally there are two types of attachment style that form in the early years, usually by 18 months, in a child's life. So if a caregiver is regularly and consistently meeting a child's physical and emotional needs, both are important, then the child will develop a secure attachment style. So that's informing how they are viewing themselves, their expectations of others. So the expectation that others care about me, others will take care of me, are good and nurturing. And also how they're understanding relationships at large and the world around them. And it can also impact feelings of self-efficacy as well. So with a secure attachment, generally there is correlation to healthier development physically, mental health, and social skills are better. Now, if a child's needs are not consistently met physically or emotionally, that's when an insecure attachment style might form, and that is correlated with generally more negative outcomes in regards to emotion regulation, physical health, mental health as well. Now, it's impossible to be a perfect caregiver, and I'm sure any of you who are parents will know you're going to get it wrong sometimes, and that's perfectly normal. And one of my favorite facts from attachment theory is that's actually an opportunity to strengthen the relationship in the attachment relationship. So when a primary attachment figure or a caregiver misses the mark, gets it wrong, their ability to initiate repair, so that conversation of, I'm sorry, of, oh, you really needed my attention, I couldn't give it to you then, like now I'm here, being able to do that repair actually strengthens the attachment relationship and is also a beautiful opportunity for teaching some relationship skills and emotion regulation skills. So what does this look like in a school, in your classrooms? So, like I said before, the two components of the attachment relationship, that secure base and safe haven, are mirrored in a classroom. So what that might look like, let's say you are giving your students an opportunity to do some independent work. Whether or not that's what they want to be exploring, you're giving them an opportunity to go out and independently explore. You're acting in a secure base role. Let's say, and I'm sure many of you can think of an example of a time, two students had a conflict in your class and you had to help them work through that, talk through that, resolve that. That's you acting as that safe haven, because while you're also maybe setting some consequences there, you're also hopefully acknowledging how both students feel, giving them a space to be heard, and to organize and understand their feelings. Now, in the same way that the quality of a caregiver-child relationship correlates to their general outcomes in terms of mental...
Thank you.
Okay. But like I was saying, the affective quality of the caregiver-child relationship impacts long-term development and growth. Similarly, in a classroom, the affective quality of the relationship between the teacher and the student is related to how that student is going to do, both in terms of academic performance and in terms of their social experience and social skills in the classroom, both with adults and students. So one study talks about how if students have a feeling that their teachers have negative expectations of them. So if your student doesn't think that you believe in their ability to succeed, or you don't think that they're capable of something, they're going to be less capable of doing that thing because of the lower self-efficacy from that belief of how the teacher views them. So again, really important to foster and build those supportive relationships with students, because this is going to help them in all areas of growth. Now, for a younger child who developmentally has fewer social skills, fewer emotion regulation skills, obviously this role is going to be much more significant, because it is developmentally appropriate for, let's say, your second grader to be more dependent on the teacher for support, whereas your 10th grader probably has a little bit or a lot more skills in their toolbox to be able to manage some things independently, but their brains are still growing too, and they also still need you in both of these roles. I really like this image because it shows how that student's attachment style is going to impact all areas of their life in the school. So their attachment style, so remember, that's those internal working models for how they view themselves, others, the amount of trust they have, also impacts the tools that they have, is going to impact how they interact with you, the teacher. It's going to impact how they interact with their peers, and it's going to impact how they interact with the school environment at large and that broader community. And I also like that the parents are included here, because I am sure many of you know it is really helpful when you can have that collaboration on all fronts for learning. And especially, again, since so many of these social and emotional skills are being taught both explicitly and implicitly in the classroom, it's really helpful when parents are on the same page and there's shared language and collaborative communication from both ends. Okay. So before we dive into the next section, I just wanted to take a quick moment to answer any questions that have come up specifically around attachment and attachment theory. Yes?
On the screen before that, I'm not sure what you meant by effective. The effective model. The one before that.
Oh, sorry. Hit the right button.
Effective.
So affective quality would be that like emotional relational quality. So like warm affect versus a cold affect. So it's less about the things you do and how that relationship feels. Like if you interact with someone that feels kind of aloof and off-putting, it's probably a more negative affective quality versus, you know, we talked about a teacher that felt very warm and inviting, that would be a like better or warmer affective quality. Does that make sense? Any other questions? And if something comes up later, feel free to write it down and we can circle back at another time. Okay. So before we talk about social emotional development and learning, I want to talk about our definition for the end goal of development. In the same way when a child is physically developing, we're trying to help them grow up to be healthy. If we're thinking of social emotional development, we're trying to encourage mental health. So mental health is not feeling good all of the time. It's having feelings that make sense in context and having the skills to be able to manage those feelings. So I'm sure many of you can think of day-to-day moments where you feel frustrated, annoyed, maybe sad. I know I was feeling a little stressed and frustrated trying to find parking this morning. And that made sense because it took me 20 minutes to find a parking spot. But I didn't, you know, crash my car or do anything inappropriate. I took a few breaths and walked in and it was fine. So that is essentially a healthy response. So, again, the attachment relationship is the setting for all development of social and emotional skills. Anything you walk away with, I want you to remember that, the importance of relationship. Now, in the same way that you can't expect a child to watch a video of someone reading and magically know how to read from seeing that, we can't expect children to learn all of their social skills and emotion regulation skills just from observing those around them. Now, they do learn a lot from modeling, those implicit learning opportunities, you know, mentioned before, seeing how one teacher interacted with other teachers in a warm and respectful way, and that was inviting for the student, right? But there are some things that need to be taught, and different students, depending on what their family environment is like or just their temperament and natural aptitude, may need some skills explicitly taught that come naturally for others or appear to come naturally for others in your classroom. Now, the way we learn emotions is both through co-regulation, so the experience of someone, usually an attachment figure or a safe adult, supporting a student in doing that together. So it might be taking those breaths together, validating how they feel, practicing a new coping skill together, and then they'll eventually be able to do that on their own without you there. And it is done through emotion socialization, which is just a very fancy way of saying the way you talk about and teach feelings, emotion regulation skills, and social skills to a child. And so in the same way that with attachment, there are things that are generally supportive, and you want to do that most of the time, but we're all human and we're never going to get it perfect, right? With emotion socialization, we have some generally supportive responses and generally unsupportive responses. You're going to have moments where you're unsupportive, and that's okay. The goal is to be as supportive as much of the time as possible. So things that are generally unsupportive would be things like you being distressed by a student's emotion or expressing that you're uncomfortable with a student's emotion. Again, that's different than how they are expressing that emotion. Minimizing their emotion, so be calm, it's not a big deal, get over it. Ignoring someone's emotions, a punitive reaction to the emotion, and again, that is different than having a consequence for how that emotion is expressed, right? If a student steals a pencil from a classmate and breaks it because they're mad at that classmate, you probably need to have a consequence for them breaking the pencil, but that's different than telling them, you got angry, now you're getting a punishment, and dampening emotions. Things that are generally supportive would be warmth, encouragement, emotion coaching, so that, again, helping a child identify how they're feeling, figure out how they can respond to that feeling and supporting them through that in conversation or hypothetical conversations about that, problem solving, and emotion-focused discussions. Now, I do want to name problem solving is a supportive response, but it's helpful to be aware of how the brain works. So if a child is very emotional, let's say they're very angry, very anxious, very overwhelmed by that feeling, they're back in this part of their brain, their feeling brain, and their thinking brain up here is not online, and you need to help them soothe and regulate that feeling so it's not so overwhelming before they'll be able to engage in problem solving. Okay. So what does this look like in a classroom setting? So CASEL, or the Collaborative for Academic, Social, and Emotional Learning, has a five-part framework for SEL, or social-emotional learning. I may use those terms interchangeably going forward because the whole thing's a mouthful. But the five parts of their framework are self-awareness, so knowing what you're feeling, self-management, knowing how to regulate or manage that feeling, social awareness, understanding and empathy for the people around you, relationship skills, knowing how to interact with the people around you, and responsible decision making. And one of my favorite parts of this framework is the way, if you see the outer rings, how they include the different environments where this learning is happening. So they talk about the classroom, the school at large, families and caregivers, and communities. And again, all of these places are settings where these skills are developing. And like we talked about briefly with parents, the more collaboration, understanding, mutual communication that there is about these topics, the more we can provide consistent messaging and support the development of these skills for children. Now, a lot of conversations around SEL and classroom management are really focused on what the students are doing and how the students are doing. But I think it's important to also remember that it's important how y'all are doing as the teachers. You know, I'm sure many of you have heard the expression, you can't pour from an empty cup. If you're feeling depleted, if you're not doing well, if you're dysregulated, if you don't have a clear understanding of how to teach the social emotional skills, it's going to feel really hard to do that with your students. And so I don't know if we have any administrators here, but if we're thinking about the learning context or the school environment, it's really important for the school as an institution to be checking in on and supporting how teachers are doing mentally, but also equipping you with the tools that you need to feel confident in supporting students' social and emotional learning. Whether that's providing specific curriculum, whether that's supporting you in attending professional development. I think I see a few faces I recognize from some of the REACH collaborative problem solving trainings, but things like that, so you feel confident in being able to do this. Because it is hard and maybe not something you thought about going into teacher-specific academic subject. Okay, before we dive into classroom management and classroom application of some of these things, I wanted to take a second to check in about questions that have come up so far. Okay, then I'm going to keep going. Yeah. Okay, we're going to end. So, classroom management is not just the way that you discipline students or respond to behaviors or misbehaviors in the classroom. Classroom management refers to all of your practices related to establishing the physical and social environment of the classroom, regulating routines and daily activities, and the ways that you work to prevent and correct problems. So I want to talk about these four principles of effective classroom management because you'll see in a second that they're very closely parallel to the basics for the pedagogy of social and emotional learning. So this idea that the things that you're already doing in your classroom to set up your space, to set up your lessons, to respond to students' needs as they come up, whether or not you thought about it in that way, those are moments of social and emotional learning. And there's ways to add to that as well, but I really want to focus on what's already happening in your classrooms and how we can grow and expand that to continue supporting students. So first, effective classroom management is based in planning and preparation. It's proactive, not reactive. So whether that's creating specific handouts for students if there is a conflict, having a set problem-solving routine that students understand and know that they can expect to go through, whether it's having specific check-ins and check-outs or specific routines at the start and end of class every day, or even just you taking time to think about how you might respond to different things that can come up in your classroom. And I know you can't anticipate everything, but the more you can prepare ahead, the better, because that raises the chances of you responding rather than reacting. Because just like in any relationship, in your relationship with your student, if you're feeling particularly emotionally charged, which I know sometimes there are a lot of different feelings students can pull on, it's hard to respond with as much of your thinking brain online in the way that maybe you would like to respond. So preparing ahead can help with that. Effective classroom management is an extension of quality relationships. Relationship is key. So what that looks like is that warmth and responsiveness that I know came up in a few of the positive teacher memories. So that really working to build those relationships with your students, make them feel valued, but also effective classroom management and quality relationships have clear boundaries and consistent consequences. I will get into what consequences might look like a little bit more on the next slide, but the idea that you're clearly communicating to your students what the expectations are, and then having a consequence that makes sense, that the aim is to be reparative and a learning opportunity rather than punitive. And so we're going to talk about more on the next slide. Effective classroom management is embedded in the environment. So it's something that is built in to the way that you are running your classroom and supporting your students. So this might look like having physical material supports that are helpful for students. I know some classrooms will often have like a calm down corner or visual aids for helping students regulate their emotions. It might be from a more executive functioning perspective, material supports around here's our system for turning in papers or turning in your assignments and it being very clear cut. And in terms of routines and structures, that can look like having a consistent routine at the start and end of class. Maybe your students have a very clear moment where they do a warm-up activity about their learning objective, and every day when they leave, they're expected to write down their homework, and you give them a minute to do that. Whatever it is, even if those routines aren't specifically geared towards social-emotional learning, that structure you're providing, that clear expectation for the students of what a class might look like, even if it's just those bookends, can actually be really regulating and soothing for students. And lastly, effective classroom management includes ongoing processes of observation and documentation. So again, it requires you to be spending time reflecting on how things are going in your classroom and considering what changes you might make as the adult to support the students and meet them where they're at developmentally. And I know you probably do this constantly already with your academic work, making sure you're noticing where students are at. Are there lagging academic skills that need to be reviewed? Similarly, doing that with some of these social and emotional skills that might come up in the classroom. So that might look like recognizing that, look, the way we're starting class just is not working for my students. I've done it this way every year, but they need something a little bit more. They're having a hard time settling in after lunch to come into my class. So how can I adapt that at beginning of class routine to support their transition in and think about what's going to help them most? So if any of you have done the Clapper problem solving training, I'm sure you're familiar with the idea of people do well when they can, not when they want to. So the idea that if there's a lagging skill, if there's something that the students need help with to be able to meet an expectation, giving them an opportunity to, in a scaffolded way, work up to whatever your goal expectation was. So now looking at the pedagogy of social and emotional learning, we have four principles that actually are very similar to what we were just talking about. So first, build caring relationships. Relationships are going to come up on almost every slide. So this can look like you expressing interest in the work that students are doing, interest in what they're doing outside of school if they want to share that with you. Also supporting the relationships between students, opportunities for peer work, team building activities. You know, again, it's giving them opportunities to practice those social skills. Teach social emotional skills through social emotional learning. So like we talked about, there are implicit opportunities for social emotional learning, but again, we can't expect someone to watch a video of someone driving a car and then magically know how to drive a car. So it's creating explicit opportunities to teach these skills. So this might look like integrating it into an academic lesson. So if you're reading a story with characters, stories typically have conflict, giving students an opportunity to hypothetically think what that character might be feeling, what they might do if they were in that character's position, and build some of those skills that way. Can also look like, again, if you have a set way that you work through problems with students that is clearly communicated to them, and through specific FEL curriculums. And I know, again, if there are administrators here, that's more of a school-wide discussion if things like that are going to be implemented. Number three, setting firm and fair boundaries. So like we talked about in the last slide, this is a part of building a quality relationship with your students. It is having firm boundaries and being warm in how you're maintaining them. So clarity of rules with consistent, logical consequences. So how often do we see rules in a classroom along the lines of like respect your classmates, right? What does that even mean? What do you expect of a student when you tell them to respect their classmates? If anyone wants to share. Yes. Treat other people the way you want to be treated. Anything else you would expect? Yes.
Listen when someone's talking.
Listen when someone's talking. Was that what you were going to say? Any other ideas? Okay. Yes. Boundaries, like physically and emotionally. Okay. But that idea that there are so many things we mean in that one sentence, and to us as adults with fully developed brains, it seems intuitive, but to a child, maybe a 10-year-old, that's still figuring some of these things out, breaking that down into really saying what you mean by that is going to set them up for success, right? And that might seem like a silly example, but there are a lot of rules and expectations that we as adults have that we understand all the parts of because we're adults that our students might not fully understand yet. And then in terms of consistent logical consequences, this comes from an Adlerian parenting theory. And so the idea of a logical consequence is that it directly relates to whatever the behavior or misbehavior was, and that it's reparative in creating an opportunity for growth, right? So if a student takes a pencil from another student and breaks it, a logical consequence might be they have to replace that pencil. It might be needing to apologize to that student or helping them apologize to that student. But it's something related that is focused less on punishment and more on building the skill or repair. And lastly, share responsibility with students. Now, this is a really hard one because classrooms can be very chaotic environments, and most people don't like chaos and try to grip onto control as much as they can. And that's a really normal reaction. But it's actually in the moments that you give your students more responsibility that you're giving them an opportunity to meet a higher expectation and also practice some of these skills towards independence, if we're thinking of that secure base role that you're, you know, playing as a teacher. And it's giving them those opportunities to explore and build those skills. So some things that can look like, yes.
That's what I wanted to ask you. Can you give
some example of sharing? Yeah, I was just about to. So it can look like at the start of the year, or maybe even the start of a term, if you're making class rules or expectations for behavior, letting the students contribute their ideas. It doesn't mean that you might not have things you add in. It might be your students are all on board eating in the class, but that might not be a boundary you're willing to, you know, cross, and that's okay. But it's giving them an opportunity to contribute and think about why or why not you're agreeing to a rule. It can look like including choices of, okay, you need to do one of these two things for homework tonight. And again, I know that's hard. It can be more work on a teacher. And really the goal of all of this is finding what works in your classroom for you, because if you can't maintain and sustain these things, then it's not going to be particularly helpful, right? So it's going to look, every teacher's going to have their own flavor of doing this that is still supportive. But another idea for sharing responsibility with students can be something like letting the students contribute to creating the rubric for an assignment, which can sound wild, but you would really be surprised, especially with some older students, of the standards they'll hold themselves to if you give them an opportunity to contribute to their own academic growth. Okay. Now, as I mentioned, having a curriculum can be really helpful. I know some of the schools are utilizing social thinking model, and again, I know REACH frequently offers collaborative problem solving, which is not in and of itself an SEL curriculum, but definitely is giving you tools to support the development of those skills as a teacher. These are just two examples. There are so many. If you go to CASEL's website or a lot of, there are a lot of similar organizations that will just list different potential curriculum and trainings you can do and use. The goal is really to make sure you, as the teacher, feel like you have enough confidence in communicating these ideas to support a student. It's not that there is one magical right curriculum. And again, I know this is more of an administrator thing. Okay. So, we're going to take a moment to think about what integrating those different aspects of SEL in the classroom might look like. But before we do that, I want to give a moment for any questions that have come up. Okay. So I'm hoping to be a little bit more interactive here. So instead of me just rambling off some ideas, I'd love if we could popcorn some ideas potentially for each of these areas. So first, for self-awareness. So again, that's that ability for a student to understand what they might be feeling and how, what they're thinking and how that influences behavior. So any ideas for ways that you might already be supporting this in your classroom, or ideas for how you could support this in your classroom? Yes. Yeah. So a punitive consequence is something that would be punishing a child, right? So one example I see a lot is like a recess taken away. And I know sometimes it's hard to find what's going to work best and there's something set up by the school. But if you have a child that's, I've heard of kids and I've had clients that have had recess taken away for having a hard time sitting still, which I heard some giggles, like it feels counterintuitive. If they need to move around, that's not a supportive response. That's not a consequence that's helping them develop a skill that they need. Does that answer the question? Okay. Yes.
I think maybe verbalizing the process that you see that child go through will help them be more self-aware.
100%. Yeah. No, it's okay, we're about to back. Do you have an example of a time you've done that in your class that you can pick up? Naming it to understand it, and so I hear a lot of like positive reinforcement of things that you saw that they did well, and you could even, depending on time and context, I know a lot of things are, you're juggling so many things in a classroom, and I really want to hold empathy for that, that you're always multitasking, but if there's space and time, even being able to help them consider, you know, what was I feeling that led to the conflict, what did I notice in terms of how it impacted the kids around me? So you're both naming it and giving them an opportunity to self-identify. I love that example. Any other ideas for self-awareness? Yes. Yeah. So trying to figure, oh, sorry. Which I think that also gets into self-management a little bit too, that idea of, for those, I don't know if everyone heard, but she was talking about having a student that acts really silly when she's overwhelmed or dysregulated, which is really normal, and being able to have a conversation about why that behavior was happening, what was leading to it, and then talking through alternative reactions that she could have instead to whatever that like trigger emotion or feeling or thought was. And so I love, and self-awareness and self-management do often intertwine. She was recognizing what she was feeling and then able to make a new choice. So going off in that direction, any other ideas for self-management? So helping students figure out how to manage their emotions, their thoughts, behaviors, and how those things are intertwined. Yes. I also hear you as the teacher kind of proactively recognizing, hey, this thing has been hard for my student recently. I want to set them up for success. Let's take a moment to think through different ways they could manage that feeling or behavior so that they can do the thing that I want them to do and I know they want to do. So I love that. I think it shows the connection and also definitely is self-management support. Okay. Yes, all the way back. So for, I don't know if everybody heard, but the example of being able to write or draw and using that as an alternative response to just blurting out in class. And so supporting that, because I know some teachers in classrooms will be very strict about, you know, kids doodling or being off topic or not seeming to pay attention, but that idea of you're noticing it's an adaptive response for many students and encouraging that as they're learning those impulse control skills. I love that. All right. Any other examples for self-management before we jump down? Yes. They need a moment to walk away, and that is a coping skill in their box. I love that. I see a hand over here.
Hi, I was wondering, when it comes to like self-management and social emotional learning, does it matter that a kid has the like the physical history of every day spending the whole day in school, a feeling like a change might be like emotionally like dangerous for the kid because they don't know what to expect. So is there a way to show kids what to expect in class? Because they go every single day and like I guess they just feel like it's inconsistent when all of a sudden the classroom changes.
Yeah, so a lot of it in that spirit of being proactive, obviously like setting up these norms at the start of the year or the start of a term, kind of when you're coming together to talk through this is what our classroom's going to look like, and even having conversations as things are changing. I saw a hand here too.
Sorry, no, I was just gonna, I don't know if this, this is kind of sound like as a student that have a difficult time with transitions. Like one of the things that sometimes we implement is like during the transition is quite like a little something that they can hold on to the other transition from like one class to another, and then if that's what they bring it back, it's like a little class or something.
I don't know if you ever really agreed that idea of having like a transition object, depending on the age group, whether that's a toy or something that they can carry between classes. But are you talking about like if you were to start implementing something like this and that shift?
Yeah, if there was like, you know, like just something like I feel like they wouldn't pick up on the difference like instantly because they think, you know, one day, one day they struggle with math and then they get over it, but they have to like worry about what's going on between themselves and the teacher emotionally. I feel like sometimes if you give like a consequence or if you tell them like, you know, you have to do something, like some kind of like classwork. They just feel like it takes more time out of their day because they have to get like they have to get like more information out of the teacher. It's hard to like explain to the kids.
Yeah. So again, a lot of these things when it comes to the emotions and the relationship piece between the student and the teacher, whether or not anyone is talking about it consciously, those students are feeling and thinking about that a lot in the same way that they're thinking about their relationships with their peers and with their parents and their siblings. So there's no way of ignoring the relationship because it's always going to be there. Now, it is finding that balance. If you're trying to engage a student in a conversation that they have zero desire to be a part of, yeah, it's going to be pretty hard to support that. But it's building those routines and understanding. So when you have the foundation of the relationship, there's the trust, and so students may be more willing to engage in an emotion-focused conversation when they are upset and have more understanding of how that's supporting them. I know it can be a hard transition, and it may be if you start doing this and you've never done something like this before, it's really normal, whether it's in a school setting or at home as a parent, when you're making any sort of change to how you're guiding and supporting kids, there is the transition period, and transitions can be hard, and if their expectations are shifting, even if it's in a supportive way of how you're changing, you're probably going to have a little pushback for the first week or so if it feels really new. But that doesn't mean it's not supportive and not going to support long-term, easier classroom management. Okay. I'm keeping an eye on time. Okay. So, trying to decide because we have about 15 minutes. Let's do quickly like one example for each of the remaining ones, and then we're going to move on to the next activity. So does anyone want to share an example for what social awareness might look like in a classroom? Yes, in the back. So for people that couldn't hear, the idea of using stories, which as a drama therapist, love stories always, but of using stories, whether they're personal or fictional, to share and normalize some experience students might have and also to learn a little bit more about what other people experience in the world. Any examples people can think of how they build relationship skills in their classroom? I don't see any hands, but, oh, yes.
Yeah, I find that if a teacher can ever find out something about what's going on in their families, happy events, and the special guests they have, any celebrations of the family, they get so thrilled when the teacher, like, looks at them as a person.
Yeah. So finding those moments that connect on just a person-to-person level with your students. Another example, just to show how inherently tied relationship skills are with academic learning, if you've ever had your students do a group project or group work, you're helping them build relationship skills. And any ideas of ways to facilitate responsible decision-making in your classrooms? Yes?
I've heard a few years ago, having like a big assignment night.
One of these two essay type things.
Yes.
Yeah, I love that. So giving them an opportunity, like we were talking about before, also it's student voice, student choice. You're giving them opportunities to share the responsibility in their learning. Okay. So I'm hitting the wrong buttons. I know on the handout, and I'm going to put it on the screen in a second, we have a like paired activity so you can spend some more time reflecting on, since reflection is a large part of effective classroom management, how you're managing your classroom currently. But before we do that, are there any questions remaining? Okay. I don't see anything, but you're welcome to grab me and ask one while we're doing the partner activity if it comes up. Okay. So, we're going to do a think, pair, share, which is both used in, I'm sure many of you have done something similar in teaching, but it's also a really great tool for social-emotional learning. Again, talking about the way your academic practices are inherently merged with the social-emotional learning, because it's self-reflection in the think. The pair and share is some not-so-vulnerable communication skill building and relationship skill building, because you're talking about it, but it's just one person, so it takes the pressure off. And then share with the group as a whole, if people are feeling brave to share. So if you have someone sitting near you that you can pair up with, ideally someone that might teach close to the same age level as you, if possible, just because, again, what first grade classroom management look like is going to be different than high school. And first, I want you to reflect on something that you feel is going really well in your classroom management right now, and think about why it might be effective and what parts of SEL is this classroom management strategy helping students develop, because if it's going well, I can guarantee you it's facilitating development in some way.
Okay.
Thank you.
and I want to be respectful of your time, because I know everyone's going to be on a mad dash to the next presentation after this. I'm curious if there were any thoughts or reflections that came up that people would like to share with the group about what feels like it's going well and why, and how that might relate to attachment or social-emotional learning. Yes?
My partner shared that before she's working on one-on-one setup, before she started that was a need to know, she always asked, she always wants the next connection. Asking them how was your night, how was your summer, kind of like what she said.
Yeah.
But on one-on-one setup, it's so important because it's much more consuming. So when you show, when you have the connection before you actually start the learning, then you contribute to the social learning or environment.
I love that. It's building the relationship. It's checking in and self-reflecting for the student. And also recognizing where they're at so you can get a gauge of even thinking to the effective classroom management of how you need to be constantly reflecting and adapting, an opportunity to adapt maybe based on the student's needs if they're like, actually, I have a horrible weekend and I'm barely paying attention right now.
Yeah, there was no so much
classroom
management because
it's a one-on-one. I would argue that that is still a part of classroom management. If your students know you're going to have moments of one-on-one time and they know this is what they can expect of you, it's setting the social tone in the classroom. That's a part of classroom management.
Yeah, it's a different.
100%. But just really trying to broaden that idea because everything you do contributes. Okay. I know we are short on time. One more person want to share? Yes.
Sure. He and I, we share a similar group of students that are a little more anxious. So we spoke about creating a very structured classroom. Help minimize distractions, even of 10 from they will like they will distract them. So it's more creative. They need a lot of structure, providing structure, you know, not even thinking moments, give attendance, we take attendance, we do it like quietly and just getting right on this one thing after another to keep them constantly engaged. But otherwise the moment you let your guard down, they're gone, and to bring them back they're ready for to keep the, I guess you want to say, more self-management and structure.
Well, it definitely sounds like providing what is developmentally appropriate. If that class is having a hard time, it might be different than what you've done for classes in the past, but they are struggling with self-management, so you're facilitating it more by telling you, no, this is what you're doing and this is how we're doing it, and maybe different ways that they're getting to make decisions because you're providing the supports that they need. I love that. Okay.
Check my time to see if we have time for one more, but I don't think we do. We are exactly at 10:25. I have business cards and contact for Middle Drupula on that high table. If anyone wants it, feel free to reach out with questions, concerns.